Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are at, tell everybody where we are, because I called it Rye before.
We
haven't even had any of the Sagamore right now. But
we are at Rye Street. We are at Rye Street Tavern.
Rye Street Tavern. Rye Street Tavern. Where they serve rye.
Yes.
Plenty of rye.
And I will say some of the best fried chicken on the planet. I mean, we love
yes.
our
we love yes. our
whoa, 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 whoa. I've never had a fried chicken here.
Oh.
It's unbelievable.
Oh, my man.
Chef Andrew yeah. Carmelini, really amazing guy, partner of ours, the NoHo Group out of New York. They're just incredible. The food is just great. And they brought down this chicken recipe that he slightly altered from his famous place in New York, and it is just so good.
Well, Nestor's, I can almost predict, I'm going out on a limb and saying that we will be adding this to your favorite item. Nestor is obviously a huge fan of the crab cake at Fadley's. Yeah. He absolutely loves the Jennings burger.
I never had Jennings a burger. Cafe. I never had a burger with bacon, onions, and barbecue sauce. They put barbecue sauce yeah. on a burger.
He loves him some Jennings burger, and then he goes up the street to State Fair, and he lives
chicken
on the chicken and waffles.
Now, I had
so we will be adding the fried chicken at the Rye Street Tavern.
All right, so
to your menu. So.
You know, being down here, and for everybody watching on the pod, it's a little bit of a rainy day down here. You look out and you see these ships and stuff, but the dream of what this looks like now, what it's going to look like, the water around it, everything yeah. around it. I think if people come down here in phases, you come one year, then the next year, the next year,
yeah.
you'll see massive change. I mean,
yes.
I haven't been here in 6 months, and I'm already seeing things where I parked the last time I was here where you can't park anymore.
That's right. Well, yeah, I mean, it's everything, you know, goes in stages. We're going as fast as we can. The neat thing is we're actually glad for the rain today. It's somewhat of a drought right now. But we had a really, really dry period of time for the past more or less 4 months. And that dry period of time has allowed us to do a tremendous amount of dirt work. We brought in tens of thousands of yards of soil that we've helped build up the site to get it at the right
Rain's helping that today.
Today it helps. It helps with compaction. And most importantly, it just gives what needs rain around here, the vegetation and so on. But yeah, it's step by step, and you'll see big changes, big step in the first quarter of next year where our buildings start to go vertical. Roads, water, and sewer will be coming in beginning of next year, and then those will grow, and within 2 years, the outside date, 2.5 years, you'll see big vertical buildings here, people living here. There'll be people walking their dogs. There'll be people going to work. There'll be people staying in a hotel. All kinds of things will be happening down here in Port Covington.
I want to live here is what you're telling me.
I believe that people will want to live here, yes, because of not only what we're creating here and the waterfront, but also its proximity to transportation, 95 going south, north, and everything that comes with that.
Well, Mark, before we, and I wanted to jump in and dig way down on that and deeper on the project and the hard work you had to do to get here, because that's what always just blows my mind about the developers who are working with the community to get great things done, how much hard work it is on the front end. But jump back for us, if you will, in a minute. You come from a city that I have a soft spot for, because anybody that knows me know I had a thing for Tim Russert. I felt like Tim Russert
yeah.
was a brother that I never
yes.
had. And I can't think of anybody that ever loved Buffalo more than Tim Russert.
That's
I must
right.
have read Big Russ and Me 5 times. Talk to us about growing up in Buffalo. And here's Mark Weller, this young guy
yeah.
growing up there. Tell
where
us
are you?
About
Cheektowaga, Amherst, where are you?
Williamsville, yeah, Amherst. I played hockey
all
and
right.
football for the town of Amherst.
So tell us what it was. Tell us about what it was like in your household and in your schools and in your neighborhoods
yeah.
and how those lessons become who Mark Weller is today.
Well, I think the thing about growing up in a place like Buffalo, what I had to compare it to is when I eventually moved when I was 15 to Gaithersburg, Rockville, Potomac area, was that Buffalo was really an incredible place, and I think you would define it as blue collar. Even Williamsville was, where I grew up, which was probably, I'd say, one of the wealthier suburbs, you would say. But the people that I knew had people I knew and their parents had all kinds of jobs that were very similar to my dad's. And then there's a lot of people that worked in factories or worked in manufacturing or worked in municipal.
What did your
local governments. My father was a vice president of a food service company that eventually got bought. They were owned by R.J. Reynolds. They eventually got bought by Marriott. So I was exposed to kind of two worlds there, and it was incredible. I mean, you just have to think of where America was. I think in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and that's probably closer to where Buffalo was growing up there in the 70s and early 80s.
Little father knows best, even after its time.
Yes, that's right. Because while much of the country changed, Buffalo didn't, and it regressed in many ways. It was one of the largest cities in the United States at one point, and one of the wealthiest cities in the U.S. Very similar to Baltimore.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, we had an incredible amount of steel making and textiles and so on, and it regressed. But I think the values didn't, and I think the people didn't, and so it was just an incredible place to grow up. I mean, divorce wasn't very prevalent. Families were more prevalent. Things moved a little slower. I just remember it being sort of Norman Rockwell-ish, and I really loved growing up in that environment. We played outside at our houses until the sun went down, and then somebody yelled or a bell got rang, and people ran home.
Remember the bell. I remember the bells well.
We used to play in the street, and you know, fun stuff like we played what we call street hockey in the street, and we'd literally have a net on each end, and a car would come, and somebody yelled, "Car's coming," and whoever's closest to the net would move the net, and we'd let him through. We played football that same way, and it was just a very, very different time. We got a lot of snow. Snow didn't bother anybody. I remember the year I left, I don't know how many inches. I think it might have been 80 inches or something we got one month. And I remember the bus coming down the street with chains on it, with a huge mound of snow in front of my house. And the bus was coming down fishtailing with chains on it to pick me up. And I was like, do we ever get off school?
You didn't, right?
You never got off school.
It's not the Hereford Zone.
No Hereford Zone.
Only the blizzard of 77, which I remember vividly, and the tree falling through the roof of my house, and my father being outside smoking a cigar with a chainsaw, cutting it up. I remember that real well. I remember not being able to get out my front door as well. But Buffalo was an incredible place to grow up. And I think, you know, post Vietnam, my father was a Vietnam veteran, fought in the war, did a tour of combat, Army vet. And my mother was a nurse and ran the emergency room at Buffalo General Hospital. I had an incredible incredible parents who really understood a lot more than what they probably explained to us every day, but they instilled a work ethic, and they instilled a respect for family, and they instilled a respect for people in life that I don't think you could get from any other combination of parents. Like I said, my mother was an emergency urban Buffalo General Hospital emergency room nurse, and my father was a Vietnam veteran who is now an executive. So you put those two things together, and you can imagine how they feel about certain things, and violence and guns and life and that kind of thing. So I grew up in this just incredible place. And then one
day...
Do you
have brothers and sisters?
I have a little sister. She's an incredible woman. I was going to say girl. She's not a girl anymore. She's a little younger than me, but she's always my little sister. But she is a public defender in Washington, D.C. Yeah, she worked for... Actually, I admire what she did a lot, too. She worked for a large firm. I won't mention which one of the largest ones in the United States. Became disillusioned there, didn't like what they stood for and what they were doing, wanted to protect people and help people who needed it the most, people that were going to jail for, you know, marijuana charges for 3 and 5 years, people that were stealing a loaf of bread and going to jail, and she wanted to make sure she could help those kind of people. She now does murders and other much more complicated cases, but that she does that. So I get to see her sometimes in D.C. as well. But I just think overall, Buffalo is just an incredible place to grow up. But the story I was going to tell was, one day my dad came home and said, I got to talk to everybody. He said, yeah, what's going on, Dad? We're moving to Washington, I think, or I got to find another job. And what that meant in Buffalo, so my dad's company was bought by Marriott. He
and
worked for the company.
I was a
freshman in high school. Okay. My dad's company got bought by Marriott, and it, just like many mergers, they consolidate a lot of things, right? And they were going to let most everybody go at the senior level, except for my dad, and they offered him a position to move to Washington. So he said, I have this opportunity to move to Washington, move our family to Washington. I want to talk about it as a family. And it was the first time I realized that, well, I didn't even know if I had a say, but he made me feel like I had a say. And my sister as well. well, and my family sat down and we talked about it, and my mom and dad explained like that if we didn't take this job, he didn't know what his next job would be. Yeah, he'd get some kind of severance package or something, but we didn't know what the next job would be. Because in Buffalo, when you lose your job that's a good job, making good money, there is no job to back it up. It's not like the Washington, Baltimore region where you can go get another job. You might get another job, but it's not going to be
same kind of job.
It's very unlikely. So, you know, things were leaving. So
you lose your place in life after working a lifetime.
That's right. That's literally. Right. Exactly. So so we said, that sounds great, Dad. My dad came down here. They bought a house. We stayed there for 6 more months. And then eventually we followed my dad down here and we moved into what was then called Gaithersburg, Maryland. And eventually they conveniently changed the name to North Potomac and housing prices went up 20%.
It's like so, Canton. Anything was Canton. It was better than Highland.
Yeah, totally. Totally. But so we lived there. And I actually, that year I stayed back a grade, which was really interesting. Went back to halfway through the year, went back to eighth grade. Then I did 4 more years of high school after that. And did it at Wooten.
So you did half and half. I mean, that's a really tough time to be leaving home.
I got to tell you, though, it was...
That's a changeover of everything.
It was literally a changeover of everything, but it was an incredible thing for me to grow up with that base, with that understanding, with that appreciation, with those parents in that place. And I wouldn't be who I am today if it wasn't for Buffalo. But that being said, I wouldn't be who I am today if I hadn't moved to Maryland. Moving to Maryland was absolutely eye-opening. I'd never seen such things. I'd never seen such dreams become reality. I'd never seen such big things get built like was happening in Washington, D.C. Just the subdivisions around me and things that were happening, the businesses, you know, as things started to grow in D.C. And those were big years. And I think that that started to show me, okay, I have the grit, I have the determination, and I really have this moral compass that I think is really hard to get sometimes in a wealthier suburb. And I was able to take that and then use that going forward in this unbelievable, unbelievable situation of all these really interesting people I was meeting around Washington, D.C. And, you know, essentially, you know, from even Baltimore, the people you meet in this region, there's a lot of really interesting people doing really interesting things. And it opens your mind up as a young person, as a young man, to things that you just never knew were even possible. And I don't think Buffalo would ever have offered that. But on the flip side of that, I think that without places like Buffalo growing up there, I just don't think that I'd be where I was at either. So
what was your first, great journey to get to D.C. Now you're motivated by, you see what's happening. Was the big project, is it Fort Totten? Is that what it was called? Fort
Totten? That was one of my first big
ones. Is that one of your first big projects?
Yeah, that was. But I think there's a journey to get there that I think matters more than that. And I think this is what I like to talk about sometimes with young folks. I used to do this once in a while when I met somebody's little brother or cousin or when I could be helpful. But like, I think out of college, it's great. Like, I had a couple friends that knew they wanted to be doctors or knew they wanted to be lawyers, and they were on a direct path. But there's a lot of us who don't really know exactly what we want to do while we're in college, even after we graduate college, right? So you just got to get to work and get to something, right? And my dad gave me some great advice, and I didn't know whether he was being kind of a smartass or he was actually giving me good advice, but I look back now, and I'm very thankful. And I said, Dad, what am I going to do? Like, I was getting to the end of college, and I said, what am I going to do with my life? And he said, I don't know. I said, well, what? He goes, you got to do what you want to do. And I said, do what I want to do. What the hell? What is he talking about?
I want to play hockey.
I want to play pro football. Right. Do what you want to do. And looking back on that now and talking to him about it now, it's great because what he was telling me was do what you want to do. It will work out. Go do the things you want to do. The word passion wasn't used quite as often and as frequently as it is now, but it's the same thing. Like, do what you want to do, man. It will work out.
And that's good advice.
It's great advice. And I think that too many people follow too many other simple things. You know, they follow money or they follow what somebody else wants them to follow or what their peer pressure is. And I say you do what you want to do, and I think things work out. And I went through a series, and I like to think that it was a funnel. I went through a series of things, you know, in real estate, many of them real estate, in construction, then in finance, and all these things. And probably the most important things I realized through that process is what I didn't want to do. So then I moved over here a little bit and did something more what I wanted to do. And I went from finance into construction and moved my way down this funnel till you got to the point where you're like, I know what I want to do with my life. I don't know exactly exactly like to exact specifications, but I'm pretty darn close. I want to build things. I want to create something. I want to leave a legacy. And I believe that the money just comes with that. But my goal was to create something. I wanted to leave something that was tangible. I wanted to leave the world a better place. I wanted to leave a more beautiful place. And that was the thinking that kind of got me to where I am now.
All right, so I got to take a break.
You got to take a break?
Quick break here. Toast my wife for bringing the cord over that keeps the show going.
Thank you, Jen. Shall go on.
I want you to come around for 1 second. His wife, your wife is a lymphoma survivor.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, the reason we're here right now is because of her, if she didn't have cancer twice, I wouldn't want to save the universe in Baltimore and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, and she knows D. Rose, and she saved the show today. So,
yeah. So there we go.
That's amazing. Thank you.
With a little sagging.
So how does that change you for coming to Baltimore and wanting to, it's raining. Stop everything. Here we go.
Yeah.
D. Rose would be very proud of you, by the way. But how does that change you to want to take a gig to come here? When you see you soon. Want to take a gig to come here and be a part of it? Because you say things change you. You said moving to Gaithersburg, your dad telling you that changed you. Kevin Plank changed you.
Yeah,
but a lot of things happened before you. Kevin Plank changed you. Right?
I think my wife getting sick and having been diagnosed with lymphoma like weeks after our honeymoon. We were literally walking on the beach in the Cayman Islands.
You're in your 20s at the time.
I'm in my late 20s. Yeah, I'm 28. And she says, I have this lump in my throat and I feel it. And I go, that's just your Adam's apple. She goes, girls don't have Adam's apples. I go, I don't know what that is. So we get back, figure it out. It's actually a cancerous tumor, and she's got a series of them growing. So long story short, she's doing great now. So like we have five
so
kids.
So is my wife.
We have, God bless. And like,
we have one kitten. That's it.
Yeah, that's cool. But the point is, I think when that stuff happens, you really have these epiphanies and these come to Jesus moments, for a lack of better terms, where you just say to yourself, I really want to do what I want to do, and I'm really sure about it now. You know, when those tragic things happen, or those things that are really life altering, or really shake you to the core, they start to refocus you and saying, I want to do this. This is how I want to spend my time. And look, I get it. We can't spend 100% of our time doing what we want, but we can spend most of it, right? Like, we've got to do some things that we don't want to do. All of us do, right? We all report to somebody to some degree, right? But the reality...
As I drink this, as you tell
exactly.
the story.
Exactly. But the reality is...
I'm doing what I want to do right now.
Yes. Yes. But that's
what brought us together.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Mark. I think you see all of that, and maybe you can sort of expand upon this. You see all of that when you go to your website and you go look up Well Development, and you begin to look at the vision and you begin to look at the mission, and you use terms like, we have the potential to transform cities. We want to do double line approach. We want to be financially viable, but we want to have a positive social impact for our surrounding communities. I mean,
yeah.
To me, I get a sense that's more than just a few words on a page of a website for you.
Well, look, here's the deal. If you want to be successful, you have to be successful on all fronts these days. It can't be about the money. It's got to be about something bigger. First off, the workforce in today's world doesn't want to work for a place that only thinks about money. And it's certainly not what I want to do either. So we really set out to be a truly double bottom line company and really focus on...
Define that, double bottom line, for people that have never heard that phrase.
I think the best way to put it is we want to take you know, the priorities of our shareholders, in this case not shareholders, it's investors, and make them equally as important to the priorities of our stakeholders, and vice versa. Our stakeholders and our shareholders are just as important, and our shareholders or our investors are the people that put money in this project that are looking for a return. Now, when you do that, you invest with like-minded people. Kevin Plank is one. There's a guy that truly lives his life by a double bottom line. Goldman Sachs Urban Investment Group that we're tied into, Margaret Anadu. There's a group that lives truly by a double bottom line. But then we want to make sure that we're really lined up with our stakeholders. Our stakeholders are the South Baltimore 7 community that we did, the largest community benefit package I've ever seen done, over $130 million going back to the community on that. And that's where their priorities and their needs are as important as the investors' needs. And I think to be a successful company long term, that's the way you're going to do it. And you know, I was saying, it was really refreshing on the way up. I was watching earlier when I was on the treadmill, I was watching a show about with that, it was CNBC or whatever, MSNBC, and it had Mark Benioff. who started Salesforce, and he was talking about the double bottom line. He wrote a book about it. He doesn't call it the double bottom line. Sure. He calls it other things, but he wrote a book about this, and it's really refreshing to see people at that level of success going on large international television shows and telling the story about why being a responsible, socially responsible company is just as important as being a profitable company. And by the way, and they asked him, they said, well, does that preclude you from being, as profitable as you can be? And his point was, no, it makes us more profitable. That's what you've missed. That's the point. We have a purpose. We have a point. We have a focus. And I think
there's a measurement other than your wallet.
There's a measurement other than your wallet. And I think it comes back. And I think that that's what gives you sustainability and longevity as a business, as a CEO and founder of a business. And it gives that same stability and sustainability to everybody around me.
Mark Wells here. We're at Rye Street Tavern drinking Sagamore Spirits and rye. Don Mohler is here. Mark Weller here. The Port Covington Project. And Don, you pointed this out about all the stuff on the website. You can go and see this vision, right? I mean, there's pictures, there's videos, there's virtuals, there's all of that as to what this will be.
Yeah.
And I think people will be shocked. You see what was 10 years ago to a Baltimore guy, the place over where the Baltimore Sun plant was, and the ships come in, that this is going to be a different kind of thing. Tell me more about Under Armour and the expansion, not just of the brands and the rye and the things going on down here, but what does it mean to me at the Inner Harbor? What, I live 2 miles away. I shop right around the corner over McHenry Row, whatnot. I'm through this area all the time. What does this mean to Federal Hill? What does this mean to those areas?
Sure, sure. Well, let me start just by separating the things a little bit, because sometimes that narrative gets conflated. So the businesses that you see that are either Sagamore or Port Covington, these other things, are completely privately held businesses owned by different partners. So they're totally separate than Under Armour. It's either Kevin's family office or Kevin's family office and a partnership tied to it. So those are totally separate. Kevin,
as a Baltimorean, though, we think, oh, that's all plank stuff.
That's right.
Yeah, that's just kind of how we think
about it. And I think that's okay to do it, but sometimes we like to differentiate the two, because Kevin's main focus is and always has been Under Armour. That's where he spends all of his time. He is focusing on making Under Armour the best brand it can be, the best international brand it can be, and he's doing a great job doing that. And that's where he focuses his time. Kevin, for us, has been a lot of the money, a lot of the North Star vision. That's where Kevin fits in with us. Many of these businesses operate independently of Kevin, more or less. We don't lose sight of his investment or his ownership, but we're always just making sure that we're on point there. But I think that, just to be clear, like, Kevin Plank isn't running a whiskey business or running a real estate business. He's running Under Armour. That's what he does. So these businesses, though, that he's built have two different kind of benefits, and they feel like they merge together sometimes. I think the biggest thing of all that I think we here in Port Covington can do, and the distillery's able to do right here, is help change both the narrative around Baltimore and also change the perspectives of finding work, good work for people that need it the most in the city. We think we offer a big opportunity. We have over 75,000 construction jobs over the life of this project, and over 40,000 permanent jobs. That's just
how many
Port
of those
Covington.
People are coming in from somewhere else. How many of those people are Baltimore people? I often wonder. I mean, 4141 up in my backyard. We're doing Baltimore Homecoming there this week, and I saw it, and I saw the workers there, and I'm thinking, are they living in Fells Point? Or are they living in Glen Burnie? Where are these people coming from?
That's a good point. I mean, we've made a commitment to make sure that all of our new hires that we do here, especially in the construction fields, are coming from Baltimore. So you can't necessarily say all workers have to come from Baltimore, but we have significant. And we have statistics on a lot of this. We're hiring a significant amount of people from Baltimore, from the neighborhoods. The key component to doing it, and this is one of the most complicated sort of age-old issues right now in urban America, which is we have people that need jobs. They have different issues, different barriers that are affecting their ability to get jobs. Much of it is around job training and life skills training. And you know this, Don, from your previous work running a county.
And his previous work as an educator.
That's right.
Right, on both ends. Right.
This is the great challenge. And what we found in Baltimore is there is literally, I mean, I don't have a lot to compare it to, but I have a few other cities. There is literally one of the most caring and giving systems of infrastructure around philanthropy that I've ever seen in my life. The problem with it is much of it is not as coordinated and tied together as it should be. And so,
and we've been talking about that.
Yes, and because of that, what happens is you have so many people fighting these unbelievable fights, passionate people that have dedicated their whole lives to making Baltimore better. But again, it comes back to that 1 + 1 = 2 or 1 + 1 = whatever, right? We're trying to make sure it equals 6, and I believe that us in the middle of this, running one of the largest projects, very similar to what they can do over at TradePoint Atlantic, with the scale and size that we have, it allows us to be, for lack of better terms, a convener. It allows us to bring people together and say, all right, everybody in the sandbox, let's figure out how to do this together, and let's figure out how to go forward. Let's make 1 + 1 = 6 every single time, = 8 = 10. And that's what we're finding in this. And so that's what we hope to gain out of this is jobs. And the other thing, which I think is really important, and I've done this in an informal and a very formal way, is our team is completely dedicated and passionate about improving not only the lives of people in Baltimore, but also improving any physical neighborhoods in Baltimore that we can. So we're in there providing technical assistance for the neighborhoods that ask us to. We come in and provide it. So Cherry Hill, for example, is interested in doing some affordable housing. They're not quite sure how the application process works. They're not quite sure how the design process works. I'm literally spending hundreds of millions of dollars on these types of issues. I have experts on call. We can call those experts in. We can ask them to donate time. We can pay for some of that time if we need to. These are the things that we can do. We currently do it with, I have these unbelievable partnerships that we're working with people and bringing people together. You know, just recently, one of the most exciting things for me, I got a really great email from JP Morgan the other day thanking me for convening the meeting and hooking them up with the Cherry Hill Development Group. They're opening up a branch, or starting with an ATM and moving to a branch in Cherry Hill. When we initially talked about that with some of the best people in Baltimore, they said, there's no way you're going to get JP Morgan to come over here. There's no way. And I said, well, hold on. You don't know what I might know or who I might know. Let me go talk.
Why is there this reticence about Baltimore?
I think people
won't invest money here.
I think it's one of the lucky reasons why I'm here today, because optimism in many cases comes from people that have experienced success similar in other places. Here, I think there has been so much, I don't want to say lack of success, but lack of forward movement for so many years on so many fronts, that there's a lot of naysayers that say, oh, you can't do that here, or oh, you can't do that here. And I think the can-do attitude, and that's why I think we've been successful, is we've had some really great people who have come from other places who have seen success and seen what it can do, understand how to get there, understand that it does happen, bring them into Baltimore. And there's so many people here that believe as well. But you're right, there are some folks that do say, oh, you can't do that here. That can't be done. By the way, all that does is add fuel to the fire. I literally, like, if you tell me that, I literally go,
right,
I cannot wait to clip the article and send it to you on Friday night after I'm having a whiskey back in my house to show you what you said exactly we couldn't do that we could do. It just fires us
up. I live my life that way. It's awesome.
Nestor, I've got a long list for our final segment.
So do I.
I got a long
How are we going to do that? How am I going to get my questions in your question?
We're going to take a quick break. Before we go to the break, when Mark was talking, we talk about why we're so positive about the future. And you and I were talking about TradePoint off the air. But you mentioned 75,000 construction jobs here, 40,000 permanent jobs.
Yeah.
Just across the way at TradePoint Atlantic, for folks who don't know, the old Sparrows Point, 17,000 jobs. I mean, that when you give people family-supporting jobs, you're changing lives. As you said, you want to provide positive social impact for the surrounding communities.
That's right.
The way you do that, it starts with a job.
That's right. And I think you're right. I think it starts with a job. But I also think, like, and I know you've talked to some of these other folks, and you should, like, you know, my good friend, Alex Smith, Eric and Alex Smith, you know, running all the projects that they've built, now building around the country, but so many projects they've built here in Baltimore. Like, there's one great example of somebody, you know, basically creating thousands of jobs, creating a positive environment here in Baltimore. And I think that there's a bunch of people and in different respective businesses doing things similar around Baltimore, and they're all adding up. Like, we just happen to be one of the slightly bigger ones, but the reality is,
you can see you from the highway.
That's true.
You know,
but the point is that there's so many great people adding into that, and when you put it all into the cauldron of jobs, of opportunity, of goodwill, of trying to make Baltimore better, I think that it adds up to something that is really, really compelling. And I think that the story doesn't want to be told because it's not the story that sells, but the reality is, like, it's coming. This place is too great not to be better than it is right now. There's too much going on.
I'm feeling pretty darn Baltimore positive this morning talking with Mark Weller. Nestor and I are going to fight over the next segment. We've got a long list of questions.
I don't green room often, but I'm going to leave you with this. You talked about successes and failures, about all the success, and obviously you're a successful guy and you're back. I want to hear about a failure and what you learned from it. that you then learn from. Next break, Mark
when
Weller's
we
here.
Back.
We come back. We're Port Covington. We're at the Rye Street Tavern. I'm eating cornbread. I'm drinking rye. It's not a bad way to spend bye week. We're back for more on WNST.net, AM 1570, and WNST Baltimore Positive right after this.